You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is episode 20, and we are looking at the question, is Christian theism or naturalism a better explanation for life on earth? And this is Jason. I'm joined this time by Matthew Evans, and we're wanting to discuss just some of the evidences we see both from science and philosophy, but also from scripture and how that matches up with a Christian worldview. We don't claim, of course, to be experts in the fields of science, but we do see some things that anybody can check out some evidences for themselves and recognize there's powerful cases that can be made for a creator and designer of this universe, that we aren't here just by mere chance or accident, and that there's some foundational things that I think are often overlooked as this discussion usually unfolds. But new scientists, or I should say in more recent years, scientists such as Stephen Meyer, Michael Behe, and many more have brought to light some of the very clear evidences of design and intelligence behind the creation of the universe. But before we get into that, I wanted to just introduce my good friend, Matt. And maybe, Matt, you could just share a little bit about some of the things in science that have been really just beneficial for your faith and how the evidence has actually not worked against your growth in the Christian walk, but actually supported it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I would say that, and Jason and I have talked about this, that after becoming a believer, I've actually been far more interested in science than I ever was before. And I've seen everything science, I guess, has to offer as far as, like, explaining how we do live in a rational universe, and that the only explanation is an irrational creator, an actual mind created it, and it fits perfectly well. And I would just say that looking at the evidence the universe provides, it shows and I would say even glorifies a creator of those things. And the more I learn, the more it seems to, and the more honestly even secular scientists learn, I would say, as far as they are being objective, as and I would say most of them are in many ways, God is proved through what they find. So I would just say that especially in my belief, in my faith, I think science is more showing God rather than disproving God.
Yeah, and Matt is definitely, you're definitely not one of the few. There's actually a lot of Christians who have found that there's so much evidence available today that supports Christianity and supports theism. And in reality, we're told a very different story from popular media or from a lot of scientific, at least in part scientific books that have been produced lately. But I think this comes from a misunderstanding that there's actually a worldview that is the foundation that we all come to the scientific evidence. We all have the same evidence, and we all come to that evidence with a worldview, and so we interpret it based on that lens we are looking through. And so, you know, the common storyline put forward by the new atheists and many other agnostics and such is that as science progresses and as the evidence becomes more clear, there will be less and less need for God, less and less need for religion, and eventually secularism will reign and science will prove that the God hypothesis is moot. However, we're going to look at some of the evidences that go against that whole hypothesis. But one voice that has been putting this forward, this idea that science essentially rules out God, is Peter Atkins. He's professor of chemistry at Oxford University, And he'll even freely acknowledge that modern science has its roots in a theological worldview. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But he basically says now that religion has served its purpose to sort of set the table, it can now leave. It can be dismissed. He says, science, the system of belief founded securely on publicly shared reproducible knowledge, emerged from religion. As science discarded its chrysalis to become its present butterfly, it took over the heath. There is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Only the religious, among whom I include not only the prejudiced, but the underinformed, hope there is a dark corner of the physical universe or of the universe of experience that science can never hope to illuminate. But science has never encountered a barrier, and the only grounds for supposing that reductionism will fail are pessimism on the part of scientists and fear in the minds of the religious. So Atkins there, you can hear his bias. He's clearly viewing religion in general as ignorant, underinformed, prejudiced. And what's interesting is he will say it's those of faith that have this bias, so they twist the evidence. But the reality is we all have a bias, and we all have that worldview that I'm referring to. So let's talk about this. So theism versus naturalism. I think just for starters, it's important to point out, Matt, that the origin of the universe is something that most scientists will admit this is a mystery. If you push back, even for those obviously who hold to the Big Bang model, if you push back far enough, they'll say, yeah, we don't know what started the Big Bang. And in fact, the Big Bang, if anything, it provides evidence for theism, although I don't hold to every component of the Big Bang model. But nonetheless, many of the proofs for the Big Bang model show that the universe somehow got started. So steady state theory, that's basically the theory that 100 years ago the majority of cosmologists held to, which was that the universe is eternal, that it's without beginning, and it's in a steady state of existence. But Albert Einstein did some important work, and others involved in looking at the microwave background radiation, the red shift, things of that nature. What else? If someone was to ask you, Matt, what evidence is there for an origin to the universe, what would you talk about?
That's a good one. going back to kind of what we said earlier was that when you look at the Big Bang, it fits more with the Christian creation story from Genesis rather than the steady state theory, including even the cosmological constant that Einstein put in his equations when he realized that was something he did to kind of, I guess, shortcut his, to kind of get away from...
The fudge factor.
Yeah, exactly. He saw that, in other words, if you look at that, it proves closer to the biblical idea of how creation got started. I think for many, it's logical to realize that something had to have started it. If you start with materialism, which would be that only material comes from material, then even if a speck of sand was the first thing to exist, it would have had to have created everything else in the universe. It's not a very logical way of looking at things, and I think that science does a lot to, I should say modern science or methodological naturalism, which is what a lot of scientists use, which is everything's natural, there's no supernatural cause, therefore, and then they go on to do whatever kind of scientific work they do. And by doing that, they've precluded the existence of God. They've already said there can't be a God, there can't be anything supernatural, therefore everything that comes about is through natural causes. And so they're starting with a bias to begin with, and then you could never actually come to an understanding of God if you stay in that theory. Because,
No, you're absolutely right that you're right that they've set themselves up so that they can't possibly allow God. There's that, you know, that quote by Robert Jastrow that no matter what evidence we find, essentially, he says, I said Robert Jastrow, I was thinking of Richard Lewontin. He said, no matter what evidence we find, we can't let a divine foot in the door. And there's that concept of, you know, God keeps trying to make his way into this scientific paradigm, and we got to just keep shutting the door on him no matter what. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you just think about, we're talking about the origin of the physical universe. And when I hear scientists or philosophers say, yeah, we just need more time and then we'll figure out what was the cause. Well, here's the problem. There is never going to be a naturalistic cause for the universe, because that would mean that you're looking for a cause within nature. But we're talking about the origin of nature, the origin of the cosmos. So there can't be, you know, it's that logical premise. If A causes B, then B has to be the result. It can't cause itself. So the universe can't bring itself into existence and, you know, pull itself up by its own bootstraps. It is nonsense when it comes down to it to think that anything in the universe could give evidence for but anything within the universe could be found to cause the universe. And that's why the evidence is pointing actually outside the universe to a transcendent cause.
Yeah, I would just add to that too that how would I put it? Just logically, you have to have something. In science, they often will come up with something that seems almost miraculous to cause what has happened. So even in looking at a lot of neo-Darwinism, though many modern scientists would probably deny it, there has to be some sort of agent causing certain changes to happen. And even if there were, they wouldn't call that God, but it's sort of kind of a, it's almost a God of the gaps theory inside science to have an agent working to make certain things happen.
Right. And I think there's a category mistake that happens when scientists say, okay, if you ever posit God as an explanation for anything, then you're using a God of the gaps argument. But here's the problem. I can look at an engine and discover all the physical and chemical reactions and interactions that are happening there. And I can even, you know, pull it apart and see all the material pieces that fit together to make this engine work and explain it completely scientifically, in one sense. But that does not mean that I now have no need for a Henry Ford who designed the engine, right? It's. I mean, to me, it's like they're saying, therefore, since we know everything within the engine, we don't need the designer of the engine. And that's just not how we think.
It'd be like coming across a car and discovering everything about how a car works and how it's designed, and then saying to yourself, well, I created it, or even it created itself, when all you've really done is discovered things about the car. I think oftentimes when we make amazing discoveries, even Watson and Crick, when they discovered DNA, they did not create DNA, and of course I wouldn't think they would say they did, but I would say that a lot of discoveries that science makes, which are amazing, are not in and of themselves some sort of like they know where it came from or know why it works. They just discover it and they just see, oh, this is how it's been working all along, and now we've discovered it. And I think sometimes we get a little bit distracted by the discoveries themselves as something a little more, what would the word be? Not that they don't explain things, but they point towards, yeah. I would say it'd be a preponderance of evidence. The more we find out about the universe, the more it points to God rather than away. And I think one of the biggest things I've noticed is when I've listened to debates or heard scientists talk, there's kind of two different ways you can look at things. You can have the universe being, wow, it's awesome, it's amazing, or you can be like, oh yeah, we already know that, like we know how that works.
Right.
And for me, especially as a believer, I'm like, the more I learn, which I constantly want to and am learning, I am more amazed at God's creation, and I just see there's two different reactions. Often it's there's amazement, or there's like this a different kind of like, oh well, we just know how that works, and it kind of can end the debate right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is important because, you know, as we mentioned early on, and as even Peter Atkins admitted, modern science had its roots in the Christian worldview. And this makes sense when you consider that all the pagan worldviews, all the polytheistic worldviews essentially said either nature is too sacred to study, or maybe it's an illusion. There's Eastern mystical religions that would say it's an illusion, so why would you study it if it's an illusion? And then there's the polytheistic worldviews, which basically said, okay, gods have been at war to create this universe, so it really is this cosmic mess, and why should we expect to make important discoveries of a battlefield? And the Christian worldview, the monotheistic Judeo-Christian worldview, has always said that God is the originator, the one and only creator of all that exists in the physical cosmos. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as you've been talking about, Matt, really when we look at the scientific evidence, it causes us to look more towards God, to be more in awe of him and worship him. The heavens declare the glory of God, Psalm 19 says. And I think when you think of it this way, the only reason we can do science is because we recognize there's these laws of nature and that they're going to be consistent time after time. And that is how we can rely on theories, hypotheses, and actually make observations according to what we see, because there's these laws of nature, like the laws of gravity, the laws of planetary motion, things like that, laws of Newton. And a law requires a lawgiver. And so that's why the Christian worldview was the perfect soil for modern science to grow out of, because it said, hey, you can expect to find these consistent holding laws that are going to be constant. They're not going to vary. They're not going to be chaotic. They're going to be something you can base your scientific observations on. And C.S. Lewis made this point over and over. He said, you know, the only reason that naturalists, or I should say atheists or those who hold to naturalism, can do science in the first place is because they assume, contrary to their philosophical position, they assume that nature is going to be consistent and abide by these laws. But why think that they have any ground to stand on, as far as why think that these laws are going to be consistent if, in fact, there is no God as the author of it all?
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking recently about like rationalism and people who just want to use reason to describe everything. And although that makes perfect sense, and I don't think that we can, as Jason just said, that C.S. Lewis wrote in The Grand Miracle that the only way a miracle could happen is in a universe that is stable, that there's normal things that happen, that you can say, oh, that's a miracle, because that goes against what we know would happen. So that's the only way to show that. And in a rationalistic point of view, if you just say everything has reason, one of the problems you would run into is, well, if you're an atheist, I should say, or something of that nature, the whole universe has no purpose, it's all an accident, it's all chaos, it's all, we're here by some sort of cosmic, you know, absurd joke or something. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, then even if you had reason, at the end of the day, there's no purpose to anything. Mm-hmm. You know, when you die, you just die, and there's no afterlife, there's no nothing. So there would be no foundation for any kind of reason. Everything would just be absurd chaos. And I don't think any of us live that way. And I think it just proves that that's just not true.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, for those like Atkins and so many others who have heard or put forward this idea that science is basically ruling out God, I think it's just important to bring up some of these challenges. Okay, but why are there laws of nature? Why are these physical constants there in the first place? What got the universe going? And I mean, we've been talking about the origin of the universe so far, and just to think of it this way, Scripture has said for 3,500 plus years that there is an absolute beginning to the cosmos. Think about that. In the beginning, God created. In the beginning has been part of the Jewish and Christian worldview since its inception. And yet, why is it that the scientific evidence that really it's almost as if the science finally caught up with what the Bible has been saying all along, which leads me to what Robert Jastrow said in his book, God and the Astronomers. He said, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." And I think that's right. I think it's just one more confirmation that the Bible really is a supernatural book. And I know men like Richard Dawkins, I've heard him say in a debate, okay, but there's only one of two options. Either it began or it didn't begin. You know, flip a coin, you get one right, you shouldn't be too proud of that. But again, why is it that the scientific consensus, I mean, the majority of scientists argued against a beginning of the universe? And I think it shows, you know, if you have a beginning, and this is letting that divine foot in the door, if you have a beginning, then that posits something outside of the universe that had to have brought it into being, which is powerful evidence for a creator. So let's see, let's also talk about some of we've talked about the origin of the universe. Let's talk about some of the evidence for a finely tuned universe. Why is this universe specifically, and maybe even our location in the cosmos, so vital? I know that Carl Sagan tried to downplay our significance in the universe. He at one point in his book, Pale Blue Dot, said, look, when you look at Earth, and he was looking at that image taken by Voyager 1 from really outside the solar system, looking back towards Earth, he said, because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. Well, first of all, that is a very bleak outlook on life. I'm trying to figure out how Carl Sagan, you know, what motivated him, what gave him purpose to life, how did he get up in the morning if he viewed all of life as this despairing? And really, I would say, I agree, apart from Jesus Christ, we are without hope. And we really are alone in this great obscurity unless God has come in Jesus to rescue us from our sin and from ourselves. Yeah, we are without, we have every reason to despair. You know, Paul said, if there is no resurrection, let's just pack this whole thing up and go home and do something else. But as long as there is evidence pointing to a God who loves us, who created us, and to the truth about Jesus, that he really did die and rise again, we have hope. But looking at this evidence for a finely tuned universe, Matt, did you want to weigh in on just some of the basic things to consider when talking about how providential our place in the cosmos is?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I was really interested in that quote because I never really heard the end of it, I guess. And irony, I guess, is that it's like just the opposite of what a Christian would think, because Earth is by being, let's say we're alone in the universe, which I think we are. I mean, I don't know for sure in the same sense, but I think we are. But anyway, we are significant, and someone did come to save us, and it's Jesus Christ. And just like you said, you know, like he died, was buried for 3 days and rose again. That's the whole reason we're here right now today. It's the reason why we're talking about him, and that's who we want to glorify and who we want to ask everyone to repent and be baptized in him, because that's what we're here to do. And that's why we're here to talk about things that the world is looking at as the basis of reality, so that we can just talk about those things and glorify the Lord. And so, like what Jason was talking about, as science looked at all these different metrics of how life could even exist on a planet, they came up with the term Goldilocks planet. They came up with a term that said this is the only place we can find that can sustain life. One scientist put it, it was as if we were put, I forget how they say it, but as if we were just, everything was created for us and then someone put us right in the middle of it. That is what, when we actually look at the world empirically, that's what we see. And through science, it would be hard to go back and see that when we were sort of placed here, when animal life was sort of placed here. Didn't just come out of nothing. And even if it came out of nothing, there's still that, what's nothing? How do we see past to where it was becoming something? So I think that's part of one of the issues we do have looking at science is like, if God created it or it came from nothing, it would be hard for us to actually see that. And so it creates this kind of a fork in the road for faith. We have to decide which way we're going to go. But on the finely tuned aspect, I would just say over thousands of, you know, like the size of the moon, how close it is, our rotation, the way our axis is tilted, the size and distance the sun is from us, everything. I've even heard that the entire universe has to be set up a certain way so that even life can exist on Earth, which I find amazing. I think it has to do with gravity and all sorts of ways that the Earth is structured and the universe is structured. And the more we find out about even what the nature of the universe, that it's more like a fabric, it's just amazing. But yeah, there's thousands anyone can just look into, just all, if things were changed, even a micro inch or whatever it would be, life would not be sustainable on Earth.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the DNA macromolecule in a bit, but I think it's interesting, co-discoverer Francis Crick of that DNA molecule, I believe in 1953, he came up with this hypothesis because he recognized, okay, there have to be so many factors in place for any life. And we're not talking about just human life, you know, big brain hominids or however they put it, but for any of the smallest single cell organism to even begin to live, there is this host of factors that have to be finely tuned or set just right in order for us to live. And this was so convincing for him that he came up with this idea called directed panspermia, which essentially, and this was a serious scientific hypothesis, essentially said that aliens from a distant galaxy, or at least a different distant solar system, have in the distant past have seeded our planet, and with microorganisms, which of course that led to what they would term Darwinian evolution. So that was the starting point. But how interesting that the evidence is so compelling for this finely tuned universe, so it's so hard for us to come up with a good example of life originating on its own, that they have to basically push it back to aliens. I mean, they're essentially saying it's got to come from outside of our solar system because we don't see how it all comes together. But yeah, just some of the evidences we can look at for a designer. So for the ratio of electron to proton mass, it has to, for atoms and molecules to hold together in such a way as to make macromolecules that make up organisms possible, that there has to be this exact ratio between electron and proton mass, and that's 1 to 1.836. And on top of that, there's many, I mean, you just think about the electromagnetic forces, the gravitational forces. So if the gravity was too strong, then you could only have, you know, very small organisms. If it was too weak, then, you know, things are going to be floating apart. There's not going to be that constant pull towards a planet. You need to have it just right. You need to have the right color for your star. So our sun is the perfect color. If it was any redder or bluer, photosynthesis could not take place. And photosynthesis, as we know, is essential to life because our food chains are based in plants. That's the, you know, the first step in the chain. Also, our sun is the perfect mass. If it was larger, then that brightness would change too quickly and there would be too much high energy radiation. But if it was smaller, then we have the problem of the planets being too distant to support life. Or I should say the planetary distance has to be too narrow to support life. So we have to have the right size of the right mass for a sun to have that right distance so that we're close enough so that we're staying warm, but we also can't be so close that our tidal forces of our ocean are too strong. So that's why that equilibrium has to be just right. And also, for UV radiation to be the right level for photosynthesis to take place, we can't be too close to the sun, and we can't be too far away, otherwise that we're not getting enough UV radiation for photosynthesis. We are at that ideal location. You could go on and on, but the water cycle. Water is essential to life. And this is something that a lot of people have pointed out, a lot of scientists have pointed out, that water is this very unique molecule, H2O, in that it's essential to life, but it has to really fall into this very narrow range in temperature for it to be in liquid form, which is the only form useful for life. If it's too far away, if we're too far away from the sun, all of the oceans are going to freeze and no life would be possible. If we're too close, then the oceans are going to boil off. And this is what you're talking about, Matt. This Goldilocks dilemma is what they call it. That it's, you know, not too far, not too close, just right. You know, we're right where we need to be. All these physical constants have to be just so. You mentioned the axial tilt of the Earth, the rotation period. You know, that the fact that we have a 24-hour day-night cycle is essential. Because think about how much the temperature swings just from like the heat of the day to the middle of the night. And if that was to be a longer stretch, then we are getting cooked during the day and we're freezing during the night. And if it was shorter, well, then there's the problem of we're not getting an adequate amount of sunlight because the Earth would be spinning too quickly. And that would cause immense problems for, you know, wind would be severe. Tidal forces would be much more severe, wiping out civilizations. So I think it's amazing to think we have all these factors, all these ratios that are just perfect. Did you want to comment any more on that?
No.
I mean, that's kind of just laying the groundwork for, I guess this finely tuned evidence is so compelling that Fred Hoyle, former atheist, was willing to say, common sense interpretation of the facts is that a super intelligence has monkeyed with physics, as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces in nature. Mm-hmm. So again, that's where the evidence leads you. It leads you to a grand designer, to a God, and not away from him.
And I would just add too, like, even Albert Einstein believed in at least a God, a kind of like Spinoza's God, that he there is some sort of creator, but not the one that we would worship. But then again, for my money, I'd have a hard time understanding a creator that couldn't communicate with people but could create or didn't want to communicate with people, but could create, and that is the creator of all the universe, everything that's made, and to not worship that God would be, I think, an odd scenario.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and obviously that would, we don't want to get too much into the moral argument, but I'd just say real quickly that the fact that we have this recognition that some things are good and some things are not good or evil, you could say evil or you could say just not beneficial, whatever way you prefer, but the fact that we can understand that, and I can, you know, take an extreme example like murder or rape, that these are clearly wrong, and we recognize that we have a moral nature, we have a conscience. And to think that, okay, maybe there's this creator, but he doesn't care about us, or he doesn't care about right and wrong. He doesn't care about some final accounting for how we live. Well, I just want to ask you, is it reasonable to think that his creatures have more understanding or more concern about good and evil than the creator? Does that fit? Does that make sense? Or is it more logical to think, yeah, we understand good and evil. We understand there's a need for justice and an accounting. And that is because that's a reflection of our Creator's nature, that he is totally good, and we recognize deep in our bones our accountability to him, and that he's created us with a purpose. And that's, again, that's, these are some of the things that we are talking about, that all the scientific evidence we're pulling in, it points to that Creator, it points to that designer and maker. And this gives us great purpose in life. We don't have to wonder, did I come from accidental chance? Am I just the result of a giant cosmic burp? You know, I think when we, many scientists and many maybe teachers in the scientific fields don't recognize the hopeless worldview they're actually presenting. And Matt, you're just one example, but for me, I'd agree. The more I have come to know about God and understand who he is from Scripture, the more I want to study his world and see how did he do it. This is intriguing. It's fascinating to me because I now know the Creator through Jesus Christ. If you know, if the universe is just this impersonal result of chaos, it's so much less compelling and so much less fascinating to study, and there's no meaning imbued to our universe. But on the other hand, with the Christian worldview, we can say absolutely there's meaning, there's purpose, and it's thrilling to study all this because of our knowledge that we've been created by that same designer.
Yeah, I just think of Romans when it says that they knew God but did not worship him as God. And I was just shocked by it, saying that everyone intrinsically knows God. And I've listened to debates with Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, and they've all capitulated, even though they don't believe in the Christian God, that there could maybe like a 1% chance that there's an actual God, or there could be something that created everything. But I find that quite shocking when you think about how they might rail against God, but yet there's something in them that is allowing for that. And yeah, I would just look to that. You know, I think that if Sir Isaac Newton had discovered the Big Bang or had a theory, he would be like, wow, this just points to the Bible. But in Stephen Hawking's eyes, he did not see it that way. And I was going to read a quote really quick. He said, "Because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing." So this is something that Stephen Hawking wrote, which I think doesn't make a lot of sense. In a lot of ways we could tear apart that quote. One thing that I just recently was thinking about, you have a physicist who decides that the whole universe was created by physics. that just physics creates things.
Physics becomes God.
Exactly, yeah. So it's just interesting to actually look at their origin or their idea of how they organize the universe, and then to look at what's really most logical.
Yeah, so we've talked about the origin of the universe, the evidence for there being a God from that. We've talked about the finely tuned universe. And before we close out this episode, I just wanted to bring up the origin of life and how this is just such a conundrum for secular scientists. Most scientists will honestly admit there is no naturalistic explanation for how this whole life, just life in general, got started. And as I mentioned before, directed panspermia has been a hypothesis. But really, what was kind of a, I guess you could say a game changer on one level, although life even before that was hard to recognize, how could this come about? But in Darwin's day, for example, Charles Darwin wrote about the cell as if it was like this jelly-filled, giant macro molecule with no real information content. And so he really had this very simplified view of the cell. But in, I think it is 1953, James Watson and Francis Crick, they co-discovered the DNA molecule. And this was a game changer because it made the problem of the origin of life even more problematic. And I think it's just important to point this out. DNA carries the instructions for building the proteins in the functional organism. So it is the molecule of heredity containing those characteristics that are passed on to our children. The reason we have certain traits and characteristics physically is because of that genetic content that is in the DNA molecule. And I know that Bill Gates is one guy who's likened the DNA molecule, this double helix that Watson and Crick discovered, he likened it to a very, very advanced computer program, only much more complex. And that's because really it's like that computer program, it has this digital code, essentially, that gives instructions for building the various parts of an organism. And every one of us has 10 to 100 trillion cells making up our body, and each of these cells contains in the nucleus this database, and that this database is larger than the Encyclopedia Britannica. So this is a conundrum for scientists, Matt. Why do you think that even in spite of the evidence, naturalistic scientists will still say, yeah, but DNA doesn't necessarily point to God?
Right. That's a good question. Honestly, I'd probably say it's more spiritual than anything. But yeah, frankly, DNA is information. There's a huge, paradigm of science now that is looking at information sciences and where does information come from and how does it get conveyed. And the more we see information as causing replication to occur, it's much like seeing a building. You see a building, and if you just said it just happened on its own, somebody would call you crazy. They'd say there was a blueprint, there was a plan, and then it was constructed. Without that plan, it couldn't have been constructed. Without the workers, it couldn't have been constructed. And the cell contains ribosomes, and which help with the DNA replication and all these other things that have some sort of purpose to actually, here's instructions, and then they have to go by those instructions to create these body plans, whatever it might be. As Jason was saying, Darwin thought that if the cell was pretty basic, it would really fit his theory. But the more we learn about the cell, it's like a giant city. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of moving parts. Everything has its place, and it knows what it's supposed to do. And it just becomes more, like you said, more and more complicated for the naturalist to look at it and say, all these things are occurring as if either created, directed, or something of that nature. And in fact, as we were talking about, the more we learn about these things, the more God just looks more amazing in how he created everything. Mm-hmm. As opposed to more simple or more, C.S. Lewis put it, God shows us things that surprise us, not something that are mundane, not something that's like, oh, that's so simple. Mm-hmm. It just keeps on being more amazing, and in no way does it make it point less towards God, but more to Him. So, yeah, just the idea of like instructions in the cell. I mean, like Watson and Crick said, this is the book of life. I mean, and they looked at it, I think, with awe. They're like, wow, this is incredible. And it just, again, I would say just points closer to Him.
Well, and just something fascinating to point out, that for thousands of years, as people studied the universe, they didn't have the scientific instruments to get at the DNA molecule, and yet they still saw powerful evidence for God. But it's almost as if God, in His goodness, says, even as you get smaller and smaller and drill down to the tiniest bits of the universe that I've created, you're going to see My fingerprints all over. You're going to find evidence for Me. You're going to see, as Stephen Meyer put it, you're going to see that signature in the cell, signed by our designer. And obviously that is a metaphor, but how interesting that there's this code, this code, which really information we know can only come from a mind. You know, if you were to visit an ancient ruins and you see, a whole line of stripes and you think, okay, they're all the same, that just looks like a pattern. But a code is very different than a pattern. A code is when there's varying symbols that together, collectively, in their sequence, spell out information. And that is what we find in the DNA molecule. I know Stephen Meyer's been hotly, I should say atheists have hotly debated this whole issue, and they've accused him of going from patterns that we see in nature to saying, oh, yeah, so God did it, as if, you know, that's all he's saying. Mm-hmm. But obviously, when we look at, say, for instance, when we drain our bathtub, we see there's this circular pattern, this drainage that happens with the water. And that's a pattern. There's no information bearing content there, but how different from that is a code that spells out the specific instructions for how to build every part of your body. You know, that to me, that's, you know, it's light years difference from a pattern. And this isn't just so you're aware, this is not just Christian theists or Christian scientists who are making this claim, but Richard Dawkins, atheist, says, what lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, warm breath, nor a spark of life. It is information, words, instructions. Think of a billion discrete digital characters. If you want to understand life, think about digital technology. And that's because information really is at the basis of all of life. So fascinating stuff. I do think we have to wrap up this episode, just given our time constraints, but this has been a privilege. And Matt, any concluding thoughts before we finish out?
I'll just say, as Christians, just I would say we should just keep on going with science. It's not, there shouldn't be a Christian that's against science. Of course, I like to use the term more not methodological naturalism, but actual science, which includes logic and just looking at the evidence objectively and not having a precluded desire for that. And I would just say, read the Bible. John 3 is a great place to start.
Amen. All right, thank you. And we will be looking at the issue of creation versus evolution. Did God use evolution? We're going to look at that in our next episode. So stay tuned.
You've been listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you want to subscribe, feel free to do so on iTunes or Google Play. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit us up on social media or send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. To hear past episodes, go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And as always, we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.